This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. We all know people who've been sick, whether with acute illness or chronic disease. But despite how common it is to be sick, not to mention the fact that most of us will experience sickness ourselves during our lifetimes, we don't always know how to deal with it in the best way. How do we support someone who's going through health troubles? How do you treat someone who's sick normally, so to speak, while also acknowledging that what they're going through is in many ways not normal and requires extra love and support? How do you navigate the situation of being a good friend and family member without being awkward? I'm joined today by Jeremy Saunders. Jeremy is an award-winning actor, producer, and host of popular original Canadian media, including film, television, and podcasts. He's the co-founder of Snack Labs, an audio production company focusing on audio documentaries and podcasts in the health and life sciences sector. In the culmination of Jeremy's affinity for laughter and education, he co-created CBC's Sick Boy podcast alongside his two best friends, Taylor McGillivray and Brian Stever, with the hopes to fundamentally change the way that we navigate communicating about health, illness, and death. All right, Jeremy Saunders, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Zale. I'm so excited to be here. I love your show, and I think this is going to be a really fun conversation.
Me too. I love your show, Sick Boy, and I was talking in the introduction a little bit about that, but Sick Boy was really born in many ways, which you co-created with a couple of your best friends, was born out of your experience with cystic fibrosis. So I think a natural place to start is maybe explaining to the audience your journey with cystic fibrosis, which is obviously a long journey, but a lot of people probably don't even know what that is, really. They've heard the term, but don't understand what cystic fibrosis is.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's funny you say, like, some people don't know what cystic fibrosis is. And I don't blame them. Why would you, if you never knew someone who had it or weren't, like, you know, a student in medical school? Actually, funnily enough, there was one time I was dating someone for like a year, and she had told a friend that lived, you know, in a different city that she was dating me. And she was like, yeah, and he has cystic fibrosis. And then this person had come to town and we met. And she was looking at me and she was like, wow, you really don't look like you live with CF. And I was like, Oh, okay, yeah, I guess not. What did you expect I would look like? And she was like, well, I don't know. I would have thought you would have been in a wheelchair or in the very least, like, had, you know, like, some issues with mobility. And I was like, I think
cerebral palsy.
You are thinking cerebral palsy. And she was like, oh, yeah, I guess so. And I was like, oh, yeah, right. Like, I guess, right. Of course you wouldn't know. It's just a disease with a name that means nothing to anyone who doesn't know what cystic fibrosis, you know, the etymology of those words mean. So I guess to give you a quick breakdown, cystic fibrosis, for anybody out there, it's not cerebral palsy.
Good disclaimer.
It's a completely different bag of tricks. It is a genetic disease. So I was born with it. My mother and my father were both carriers of the CF gene. It's called the CFTR gene. And they didn't know that they were carriers. So there's actually quite a significant amount of the population of people on Earth, predominantly white people, predominantly people in the sort of northern hemisphere of the Earth, that are carriers of the CFTR gene. And when you have two people come together that are carriers and they have a baby, there's pretty much a 50-50 shot that their child's going to have cystic fibrosis. And so when I was born in 1988, so I'm 36 years old, I was born, my parents had no idea that I had CF. At the time, screening newborns for cystic fibrosis was not a thing, to which it is now. And so for the first year of my life, my parents were struggling with me as a baby. My health was not great. I was having a lot of malabsorption issues. So, you know, it wasn't like putting on weight. I was having a hard time with digestion. And they were, you know, they were just run through the gauntlet, bringing me in to be admitted to the hospital, bringing me in for, you know, newborn checkups all the time. And they were trying to get to the bottom, like, what the heck is going on with Jeremy? And my mother's a nurse. My father is in sales for automotive parts. And my dad was out one day with a client, maybe, you know, having lunch, having a beer. And he was talking to this person about me as a newborn and these struggles I was having. And this guy that my dad was with was like, oh, well, you know what you should do? My dad's name's Cobb. He goes, you know what you should do, Cobb? Take him home and give him a bath. And then after he's fully clean, take him out, dry him off really well, and then just lick the back of his neck. And if he tastes like salt, I bet you he's got cystic fibrosis. And my dad was like, what the fuck?
Really? Yeah, that's strange.
Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah, great.
I can't help it. So my dad was like, okay. So he comes home, takes me, puts me in the bath, washes me up, dries me off, turns me around, licks me. We're all from Newfoundland. So my dad licks me and he says, the second I licked you, buddy, I knew you tasted like a salt lick. And I knew right then and there you had cystic fibrosis. And so he tells my mother, who's a nurse, my mother was like, no, there's absolutely no way. And sure enough, a couple days later, they take me in. My dad says, I want you to screen him for cystic fibrosis. And they do. And that was the result. Now, back to the why did I taste like salt? There's this ancient, like, medieval folk saying that went, beware for that child which when kissed tastes like salt, for he is bewitched and soon must die. So people with cystic fibrosis have 2 to 5 times more salt in their sweat than your average person. So for a lot of parents with a child with cystic fibrosis, this is like one of the first things they notice about their baby, is that when they go and they give their baby a kiss, the baby tastes really salty. I could get into why that is. It basically, the CFTR gene is a gene that there's a genetic mutation to the CFTR gene. It affects the body's ability to move chloride in and out of cells. So there's an excess amount of salt in the body. And that inability to move salt back and forth through the cells causes an excess amount of mucus buildup. And that's essentially the disease in a nutshell. If there's a, you know, a doctor listening or anybody who went to medical school, they're probably rolling their eyes and thinking, Jesus Christ, Jeremy, stop.
No, as somebody who went to medical school, that sounds
right. I'm talking to a fucking doctor. So yeah, it's basically the inability to lubricate the cells of the body, which then breeds that thick, sticky mucus. And so my body can't move or get that mucus out. We all have mucus in our bodies, and a normal, typical human, healthy human flushes mucus out daily. Whereas in my body, it just is so thick and it's so heavy that it sticks. And so typically, CF is known to be a lung disease, but in reality, it's actually a disease that affects every single system of the body. The way that it affects the lungs is that heavy, thick, sticky mucus builds up in the lungs, which causes, you know, it's a breeding ground for bacteria, that mucus. So that can lead to chest infections very easily. There's a lot of coughing associated with cystic fibrosis because of that buildup of the lungs. It's kind of like you're just constantly drowning in your own sputum. Gross. And so all that coughing leads to infections. The infections and the coughing lead to scarring or fibrosis of the tissue of the lungs. And so it is a genetic disease that is progressive. And over time, the lungs start to lose their function. But when it comes to things like, let's say, the pancreas, some people with cystic fibrosis have their pancreas does not produce the enzymes required to break down their food. And so this results in that malnutrition. So for a lot of people with CF, gaining weight is like next to impossible. Maintaining weight is kind of the key, and losing weight is really easy, which is really detrimental to your health if you lose weight rapidly, especially when you are already sick. There's a whole bunch of other weird, like quirky sort of symptoms of cystic fibrosis that don't get much airtime, like the salty skin thing. But it is a fascinating disease. And it's also a disease that has completely, fundamentally altered the way that I have approached life. And it's one of the biggest things that has shaped me into the human that I am today. And it's been a very interesting 36 years, to say the least.
Well, that's a really good synopsis of kind of the pathophysiology, also just the symptoms of cystic fibrosis and how that all interplays. From your perspective, as somebody's trying to picture the childhood and the life of Jeremy until this point, and what did your life look like in terms of how this sickness affected you? Were you constantly in and out of hospitals with lung infections? Were you fairly unwell with kind of acute exacerbations? How did this affect your day-to-day for somebody who's trying to get a picture of what your life looked like?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I think back to my childhood, I had a pretty normal childhood for the most part. A big part with CF, especially back then, is that parents were told, like, one of the most key important aspects of your child living with cystic fibrosis is that you force them to be physically active. So, you know, unlike asthma, where the airways become constricted and they close off, and sometimes doing physical activity can cause that restriction and cause an asthma attack, and it makes it hard for them to actually exert themselves. Cystic fibrosis is different in that the airways are the way that they are. They're, you know, they're open, but they're just clogged. And so hard, rigorous physical activity is one of those airway clearance techniques that, you know, huffing and puffing is going to bring that mucus up to the, you know, up to the upper airways and allow you to cough it out, get it out of the lungs. So I was, you know, as a kid, I was super active. I kept up with all the other children. I had no say in what I could and couldn't do when it came to like being physically active. My parents just like forced me into sports. You know, if I didn't like one, they go, all right, screw it, we'll put you in another. Just find the one that you like and just try to excel. But I also did have that one thing that seemed to be a bit different than most of my peers, which is that I would spend more time in a hospital than most. You know, a typical hospital admission for someone with cystic fibrosis it's like a 2 to 3 week period where you are on IV antibiotics, IV fluids, and you kind of just hang out. You sort of just hang out while they sort of tune you up to get whatever is going on just kind of clear, you know, increase your lung function to a certain degree or just make sure that you're not carrying any kind of excess infection in the lungs. So that would happen, you know, once a year, once every 2 years through my youth.
And that's fairly significant.
Totally, totally. But again, there was a part of it that felt normal. I didn't view my illness as like some big different thing. It started to shift as I got a bit older, though. I do remember a time in like early junior high when it wasn't the hospitalizations that was like a thing that kind of drove me nuts or took away from my experience in life. it was actually having to take my medication. I take about 40 pills a day. And so I remember like in early junior high days, which is like it's the fucking worst. Those are the worst days. Junior high is the worst. It's just everybody in your social group is, we're all trying to figure it out. We're all freaking the fuck out. You know, hormones are going wild. We're all changing. And it's such a insecure, judgmental, weird environment. It's fascinating. I feel like it's, you know, anthropologists should just be just sitting in a junior high and just watching, like, what are these humans fucking up to?
Watching insecurity at its peak.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I remember a time where like I was taking my meds at lunchtime and someone maybe said something to me and it just like all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm different. I need to hide this. And so from that moment until I was, I don't know, probably 19, I wouldn't be caught dead taking medication in front of anyone. It was this thing that I had to hide. And that was like the start of this shift that sort of made my illness kind of put up a wall or get in the way of me just truly living authentically. But there was one other moment that was kind of I would say it was one of the most profound moments of my entire life, which was cystic fibrosis is a fatal disease, right? So when I was born, my parents were told that I likely wouldn't live to see my graduation in high school. When I was about around 10 years old, the advancements of CF and treatment have like really quickly progressed, and it's been incredible over the last 30 years. So when I was 10, the average life expectancy in Canada at that time was 30 years of age. But when I was 10, I was blissfully unaware that that was actually the case. So I had no idea. I never had a conversation with my parents about the fact that CF was actually a disease that statistically is going to take my life before everybody I know. And the way that I found out was by reading a pamphlet that was intended for my teachers to give them a sense of like, hey, you have a kid with CF in your class. Here's all the things you should think about.
Wow.
And when I read that pamphlet, I remember exactly what it said. It was two sentences. It said, yeah, cystic fibrosis is a fatal genetic disease. And you can't see it right now, but in the corner here of my studio, I have a Mortal Kombat 2 arcade machine. When I was 10, I was a Mortal Kombat god. Okay. I had smoke unlocked. Like I knew very well what fatal meant. And then the next sentence was the one that like just, it was like a drop kick to the gut. It said, the average life expectancy of someone living with cystic fibrosis is 30 to 33. And in that moment, when I read that, my 10-year-old logic was like, wait, what? So I'm 10. Everything I've done up to this point in my life, I can only do two more times. I was a 10-year-old having a midlife crisis all of a sudden.
Literally midlife.
Literally midlife crisis. Yeah. And that moment right there was the seed that was planted that changed the trajectory of my life in ways that I mean, at that point I could never have imagined.
What an unimaginable experience, really, to be 10 and find out you've statistically got 20 years to live and that you didn't know that for the first 10 years of your life and how that alters the way you're going to proceed with the rest of your life. And we're going to have you back on the podcast another time to kind of speak about how that twists your mind and plays with your mind, the idea of a shifting life expectancy. Obviously, spoiler alert, you said you're now 36 and medications have come out which have prolonged your life expectancy even more than 30. And we're going to do a whole episode focusing on that because I think that topic itself is just so fascinating.
Ready to pop the question?
The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I want to go back to what you said about that fear of having your medication in front of other people. I spoke in the introduction about this idea that it's really awkward for people who aren't sick, even though most of us get sick, pretty much everybody will get sick at some point in their life. It's very awkward to know how to interact with somebody, a close friend even, or a family member who is sick, because you said in many regards you felt normal. And normal is not really a great word. Nobody's normal, et cetera. But in many regards, your experience was not normal. And mm-hmm. I am guessing that you wanted to be treated normally because you were normal. On the other hand, there's the reality that what you're going through is an abnormal experience. And my understanding is that the Sick Boy podcast, which you co-created, really talks a lot about how to approach somebody who's sick, how to deal with sickness from the perspective of the patient, from the perspective of the friend. You run it with your two best friends. I want to dig in a bit how people who are listening to this podcast kind of can approach people who are sick. And I guess that starts off with, why did you start Sick Boy podcast? What did your experience with others and your interactions with them? What was that like growing up? And becoming comfortable with that and having a couple really close friends and family members who want to support you, but kind of saying to them in some way, listen, like, I want this to be an important part of my life that you need to check in on. It does define me, as you said, but I don't want it to be the only thing that defines me. And that's a really big loaded question.
So one thing I do want to step in there and say this thing that you just said, I don't want my illness to define me. That's something that I've heard time and time and time and time again. I mean, we've had over 1,000 conversations on Sick Boy. We've been doing it for almost a decade. We're in our ninth year. And I have heard so many people that we've had as guests on that show say that exact thing. I do not want my illness to define me. That is an entirely valid thing to say, an entirely valid thought, feeling to have. I've never felt that way. I've actually never felt like I don't want my illness to define me. In fact, I want my illness to define me. But the difference is that I want my illness to define me on my own terms. I want to look at the way that I've lived my life. I want CF to play a role in how that life has been lived, but I want to be the one who's in control of the message. I want to be the one who's in control of the way it affects me. I want to have a life that is defined by my illness, 100% under all of my control. And I think that's been a really big kind of part in how that moment when I was 10 kind of affected me, because I had no control in that moment. My control was taken away from me when I was basically told, hey, you're going to die at 30. And so from that moment forward, it was like, all right, well, fuck that. I'm going to take as much control as I possibly can. And everything that's outside of my control, well, hopefully I'll get to a point where I have the wisdom and the clarity to understand that those things are going to happen. And that's okay. That's not the stuff I need to worry about. But whatever's in my control, that's what's in front of me. And that's what I got to focus on.
What do you think the biggest difference was then? You're saying you wanted to be in control. You wanted to define how cystic fibrosis defined your life as opposed to letting others be in control of that message. What do you think the difference was when other people looked at you and maybe subconsciously or consciously were defining you by your cystic fibrosis? And how did you feel? No, that's not how I want my disease to define me. I want it to define me in a different way. What was that delta?
I think it was, you know, the fact that, okay, you have cystic fibrosis, you are statistically going to die at a young age. This is going to lead to a point where your lungs will not function properly. your lung function will be low. As a result of that, you're probably not going to be able to do things that typical people can do, or maybe not do things that you used to be able to do. And yeah, probably you're right. But I'll tell you right now, I'm going to do everything in my fucking power to ensure that that does not happen until the very last moment. You know, I'm going to stretch this out, and I am going to say yes to doing things that I should not say yes to doing things to, just so I can fucking do it. Just so I can do it for myself, not for anybody else, not to prove a point to anyone, but it's for me. It's like, I'm going to do this thing. And some of those things were not good things to do, you know, like in grade 10, going to my friend's house and putting on The Dark Side of the Moon that's synced to Alice in Wonderland and ripping a massive bowl of weed, not a great idea.
Not good for the lungs.
Hell no. But you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to do it because I'm a teenager, and this is a totally normal thing for a teenager to do. And I want to have that experience. And if I am going to pay the price to do that, okay, I'm willing to do that. But in the very least, I want to just live a normal life. I want to live a typical life. And so I just tried to do that, whether it was for good or for bad. I tried to do that as much as I could.
I mean, Sick Boy is a very apt title of the podcast, just based on what you're saying there, and that people, I am guessing, look at you, maybe not anymore, but at many points in your life, and I'm sure sometimes now, look at you as a sick boy, and that's how they define you. And you're saying, that's not necessarily how I want to be defined. I acknowledge I have cystic fibrosis, and I'm going to let that define me, but I don't want you to look at me with pity and call me a sick boy and put me in this box where I can't do stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and also sick boy, like it's funny there's, when it came to making the podcast, there was literally zero thought that went into any of it. The thought came after it had already been going. The meaning of the podcast came after it had already begun. I'm going to say this, whether or not Zale, you subscribe to this kind of thought process or your listeners, but that the podcast came to me in a moment of, it was plucked out of the collective consciousness. It was, you know, the idea of the muse showed up and just implanted this idea in my head in the span of, you know, 0.003 seconds. Like it was just a light bulb moment where I heard Kevin Smith, a famed director of Clerks and Jay and Silent Bob. He was delivering a talk, and I went to school to train as an actor. I went to Ryerson Theatre School in Toronto and trained as an actor, and performance and creativity are like a massive part of what allow me to feel sane and feel like I have purpose. And I was going through this like rough patch in my career where I had this, you know, it was like midlife crisis number two, where I was thinking, God damn, I spent all this money and all this time training for an art form that I love. But the downside to this art form is that I have to rely on so many other people to allow me to do it. I can't just, you know, go down to the street corner and just bust out a fucking soliloquy, because that's not cool.
I mean, you could. You might be that with another disease, but yeah.
That's right. You could. Yes, you could. And people would just assume that you are hearing voices. So I was going through a really hard time, and Kevin Smith was giving this talk, a 3-hour keynote after a screening of one of his film Tusk. And he's a podcast mogul. And he said this thing where he said, podcasting is the perfect form of creative expression. And the reason for that is because every single person in this theater right now, for the most part, probably has a cell phone. And every single person in this theater right now has something, some topic, some idea that they are passionate about, that they love to talk about. And you take those two things and you put them together, you have a podcast. But here's the best part. The best part is that no matter how niche, no matter how weird, no matter how out there your topic is, say you're someone who just loves to knit hats for cats. Well, guaranteed there's at least one other person on this planet who is just as passionate about knitting hats for cats as you are. And when you create this art form that you put out into the universe, whether it's one person who shares that interest and wants to hear what you have to say, or if it's 100,000 people that want to hear what you have to say, it doesn't matter because this is yours. You contain, like, you control this. This is your piece of art. You don't have to rely on anybody else. And it, again, right there in that moment, I went, right. I could start a podcast and talk about what it's like to live with illness, but make it a comedy podcast where the idea is to try to find levity and humor that exists within that experience, because people don't think that illness is funny. You know, nobody thinks brain cancer is, there's nothing funny about brain cancer, and you're right, but there is something funny about the experiences, the human experience that comes with going through that experience. And I could talk about that, and I could call it Sick Boy. Literally, like the name right there was like Sick Boy podcast, a comedy podcast about illness, right? All right, maybe I should do this. And I sat with it for a few months and was toying around in my head and was hanging out with my two best friends one day. And we were talking about like just things that we could do together, whether it's like, you know, start a business or do something creative. And I told them this idea. And, you know, they are, Brian and Taylor are two of the most ambitious people I've ever known in my life. And as soon as I said it, they were like, okay, well, let's record the first episode right now. All three of us, Jerry, you be the guest. We'll be the guest hosts, and we'll talk to you about what your experience with CF was like, and you tell us. And so we were in the Halifax Central Library, this new building. It was beautiful. And they had these free recording studios. So we just walked in. There was an audio engineer there. We had no idea how to operate anything. And he goes, yeah, sit down. I'll turn these mics on. You guys go for it. We sat in there for an hour. We talked. And when the hour was up, we were like, holy shit, that was so fun. So we went home. I downloaded GarageBand on my laptop. We put the audio files in. We spent like 3 hours chopping it up, and we cut it down to like 45 minutes or something. And we listened back to it and we were like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, okay, that was fun when we were doing it, but listening to this, like there's something here. Like this was, it was hilarious. It was extraordinarily eye-opening and educational for Brian and Taylor. They learned things about me and my life and experiences that they had never heard before. And for me, it was extremely empowering. It felt so good to just sit with my best friends and just spew out like I was talking to my therapist, meanwhile laughing the whole time. And so, you know, we were like, well, we're three best friends. This could be a fluke. You know, can we recreate this with somebody that we're not so close with? And so we put our heads together and we thought of the sickest person we could think of at the time. And I had like a buddy who I knew, but I didn't know that well. And I had found out that he had just had a brain tumor removed like a month ago. And so I texted Matt and I said, hey, Matt, I heard you had brain cancer. We just recorded this thing. Do you want to be our second recording? We'll just shoot the shit and, you know, have some laughs about your experience. And he was like, hell yeah, sign me up. And so he showed up. We did the same thing. And that recording was like 10 times better than the first. And that was the moment where we went, okay, I think we're on to something here. And that was the you know, that was the inception. That was the original idea. But again, you know, 5, 6, 7, 20, 30 episodes later, we started to realize, hey, yeah, this is a comedy podcast about talking about illness. This is about trying to find the levity that exists within that human experience. But this is also a lot more than that. It's also hearing the experiences of others who've dealt with illness and seeing that, like, man, people get really fucking weird when you bring up that you're sick. There's a lot of stigma attached to this thing. There's a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot of shying away from real, meaningful conversations. And every guest we had on, when it was over, they were like, holy shit, guys, this, I needed that. Like, like the weight off my shoulder to just fucking talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. And time over time after time, we've just heard so many people be like, yeah, you know, I got cancer and lost a bunch of friends over it. And, you know, it's like, what? Whoa, what? You lost friends because you found out you had cancer? And again, that just ties right back to the fact that people don't know how to be. People don't know how to show up.
I think about, I'm Jewish, so a lot of the funerals that I go to are for Jewish people, just because I'm in the Jewish community. And there's this, you've probably heard of a Shiva, or if you haven't, or if people mm-hmm. haven't heard of a Shiva, there's 7 days after somebody's funeral where you go and you go to the family's house and you kind of just console them, chat with them. It's nice in many ways. But my brother and I have always kind of joked around, and I've got a kind of weird sense of humor too, where you can always see this awkwardness at a Shiva. And granted, this is different, death versus sickness, right, but right. Some people walk
in. No, they're not. No, hold on. I want to say it. They're not different. They're not. They are the same. They are the same thing, Zale. They are no different. We are death phobic. We are a death phobic society, and we are also an illness phobic society. That is it. They are two in the same. The difference is that one just comes before the other, typically. But like, they are so similar. They are so similar. Sorry, I didn't mean to like jump in there and cut you off.
No, totally. In a sense, at the Shiva, the sick person, the patient, is the grieving family member. And you're all coming in. Everybody's good intention going in. But my brother and I will kind of laugh because we'll see some people go in. And I used to do this too. You kind of come in. You have your head bowed down a little bit. You want to show modesty, like, hi, I'm sorry for your loss. And you talk in this quiet voice. I'm really sorry. Give them a hug. My condolences. And then you see other people who aren't even you, who you haven't seen in like 10 years, who you otherwise would never see. And you're like, hi, nice to see you under better occasions. And we're laughing like, this is the only occasion I'm seeing you in like 10 years. And it's mm-hmm. just this awkwardness that is born from good intention. But people are just so awkward. And I'm not saying I'm great at Shivas. In fact, one time my brother and I came out and we're like, were we too optimistic there? Because we tried to say, let's just be normal. I feel like if my parents had, God forbid, died, I'd want people to just be normal to me. But mm-hmm. how, as somebody who's gone through sickness, where's that balance? Because on the one hand, yeah, you want people to be humorous with you. There's a phrase out there, just let the person guide you. Ask the person who's sick, what do they want? But totally. That can also be awkward too. If somebody's constantly saying to you, what do you want? How do you want me to address you during this tough time? What have you found through your experience and through conversations with people is that best balance of treating somebody normally and not being awkward and not ignoring the fact they're sick, at the same time being supportive, checking in, not being annoying? What mm-hmm. are some of those messages that you have found important? Because the reality is, it's easy for me to laugh at those people who are really awkward at Shivas. And I've mm-hmm. been one of those awkward people. Mm-hmm. I've also had friends who are sick, and I do reach out to them and say, hey, hope you're doing okay, man. Like, thinking of you, how can I be there for you? But it is tough because most people's responses are typically, thank you, I appreciate that. But they're not going to tell you exactly how to be there for you. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be overbearing, but you don't want to be not present enough to the point where the friendship actually dissolves, like you said. What are some keys? What are some things that you think people should understand better than they do?
So I let's use that example of like talking to people who say, I found out I had cancer and then I lost friends over it. I don't think that people are losing friends over a cancer diagnosis because their friends are assholes. I think they're losing friends over a cancer diagnosis because their friends are too afraid to say or do anything, and their go-to is just to pull the cord and get the fuck out. It's a safety mechanism for them to not say the wrong thing. It reminds me of the way that some people handle certain like worldly issues, right? So let's talk about, for example, like Palestine and Israel. You have a whole spectrum of how people approach that situation. You have people on one side that are screaming from the rooftops, that are calling out and confronting people in their life because they have a certain opinion or thought, or they don't have a certain opinion or thought. In the middle, you have people who can speak about it, can acknowledge it, don't get too hot, aren't too cold. And then on the other side, you have people who go, "Ah, man, I don't know. I am a white man from Canada, and I have nothing to say. And nor do I want to say anything. And if anybody brings it up in the office, or if anybody brings it up in public, I'm just going to shut down and walk the fuck away." Well, illness is kind of like that too, you know? And you could relate that to race issues. You could relate that to gender issues. People, it's the same all across the board. You've got people on every spectrum. And so when it comes to speaking to someone who is experiencing illness, try to just be middle of the road. Definitely don't shut off and go, "I'm out. I'm going to fuck it up. I'm going to fuck it up. I'm not going to say anything." Well, that's not going to help. And yeah, you're probably going to fuck it up, but that's okay. That is okay. That's how we learn. Also, don't go, "Oh, Shelly has cancer. I'm going to call her right now. I'm going to go over there. I'm going to call her while I'm going over there. And as soon as I get there, I'm going to get her. I'm going to just ask her everything." It's like, okay, whoa, cool. You know, cool. Pump the brakes. It's about reading the room. It's about having even the slightest understanding of this person that has been affected by this thing. I mean, just all you have to do is really take a deep breath and go, "Okay, Shelly has cancer. I've known Shelly for 15 years. We have a very solid relationship. These are the things typically that I rely on Shelly in our relationship. When I had my divorce from Tom, I went to Shelly and she was there for me. And this is how Shelly showed up for me. And this is how Shelly and I communicated." Okay, cool. Right. So now, all right. So Shelly has cancer. So what do I do? Well, go over to Shelly's house. Maybe you bring her a fucking, I don't know, a casserole. And the first thing you can say when Shelly opens the door and she's got bloodshot eyes and her nose is puffed up and you can tell that she's just been crying because she just found out that she has to have both of her breasts removed in 2 weeks. The first thing that can come out of your mouth is, "Shelly, fuck, this sucks." Because that's exactly what Shelly is thinking. This fucking sucks. And it's as simple as that. It's just, "Hey, this sucks. How are you doing?" Don't start with "how are you doing?" Because Shelly's going to do what Shelly's going to do what every other person in our culture does. She's going to go, "I'm okay." Or she's going to go, "You know, it's been hard, but I'll make do." No, you're not going to make do. It fucking sucks, Shelly. And I'm here and it sucks. And it's okay that it sucks. I'm going to be in this suck with you. And be real with me and I'll be real with you. And maybe Shelly says something that opens up a door to crack a joke, you know? Well, you know, if you get a new set, at least you get to choose what they look like. And hey, maybe that cracks a smile in Shelly's face. Okay, we're moving somewhere. But maybe that's not who Shelly is. Maybe Shelly doesn't have that type of sense of humor. You should know this, right? And the same goes for a stranger. Just think about it when you meet a stranger at a bar or at a party and you're introduced to this person from somebody that knows them, or you're just introduced, you're not even introduced. Someone just walks up to you and says hello, and you have no idea who they are and they don't know you. Well, how do you typically handle that situation? Handle it like you're on a first date. Show them the best version of you. Hope that they show you the best version of them. And if they happen to be standing in front of you with a bald head and a giant fresh red looking scar that goes from ear to ear, very clear that they just had a brain surgery, I mean, I'll tell you right now, that person who's talking to you, 99% of those people are going to be thinking, they're probably looking at my scar. They're probably looking at my scar. Do I say anything? You could say, it's very okay for you to say, hey, I noticed you got a fucking gnarly scar there. Is there a story behind that? And that person is going to do one of two things. They're going to go, oh, thank you so much for addressing the elephant in the room. Let me tell you a wild story. Or they're going to go, I'm not, sorry, that's none of your business. And if that's the case, okay, move on. It's not the end of the world. You know, we're so afraid of fucking up and saying the wrong thing. And again, I mean that with everything. I mean that with trans rights. I mean that with Gaza. I mean that with, you know, the police. I mean that with politics. I mean that with sex. I mean that with anything that we shell up and go, oh, fuck, I don't know, I'm going to say the wrong thing. You're not going to say the wrong thing. And if you do, that's okay. It's not like you're going to say the wrong thing and all of a sudden your dick's going to fall off. Like, just think about it for a second. It's not the end of the world if you stumble. And if you stumble and the person that you are communicating with can see that you actually are there to try and be the best version of you, then if that person's a good person, they're going to understand that. And they're actually just going to be fucking grateful that you're not like everybody else who clams up and doesn't know what the hell to do.
I love the way you just articulated that and gave such great examples about that. And I mean, that's really what Preconceived is all about in many ways. It's about talking about some of these stigmas and talking about things that, I mean, we've done an episode in Israel and Palestine, and we've done episodes on trans rights and asking some of the questions that are uncomfortable to ask, because it's important to ask them, even though a lot of society says, if you're not trans, you should have no opinion. You shouldn't be talking about this.
Right.
But the idea that it's okay, you're going to make mistakes when you're talking to somebody who's sick. You're going to make mistakes when you're talking about anything controversial. That's okay. Accept that. As long as the person you're speaking with understands that you're well-intentioned, then that should be okay. And if that's not okay, then to an extent, that's on them.
Exactly. Exactly. And like, think about it for a second. What on earth, what single thing on earth can you think of that you could partake in or experience where you absolutely 100% could not make a mistake at all? If you approach the way that most people approach speaking to people with illness, to every fucking thing you will ever do in your life, oh my goodness, you are going to live a horrifyingly impossible life. If you're so afraid to make a mistake in anything you do, then what the hell are you ever going to do? Lean into it. Lean into that discomfort. That is going to make you such a better person. It is going to make you the person that people fall back on and rely on and love and cherish. And who doesn't want that?
And let me ask you, Jeremy, has there ever been a situation, it's a leading question, but has there ever been a situation where somebody's written you, sent you a text or given you a call when you've been in one of your exacerbations, or you've been really sick and you've been like, I'm offended that person called me. Why did they call me? Because I imagine most of us, I mean, I know people who've been sick. I know people who've had people pass away. We all do. And sometimes there's a hesitation in me to send a text. Am I close enough to them? I don't want to be annoying. And then I think, well, you know what? Like, I mean, death is the easiest example in some ways. If somebody close to me died, would I be upset if I had 20 messages on my phone saying, hey, Zale, I'm really sorry. I'm thinking about you. No, I'd actually probably be more upset if I went to my phone and everybody was too afraid to write me. Yeah. I'd kind of want my phone blowing up to feel that support, especially if the messages were in the right way, not saying, hey, like, can I call you right now? Like you said, but hey, just letting you know I'm thinking of you. And I'm guessing for you, there have not been too many messages where you've said, oh, why is this person reaching out? Too random. I haven't spoken to them in many years. I'm guessing it's usually a, wow, that was really nice of them to reach out.
I mean, I'll put it this way. If I came down with a really bad lung infection and all of a sudden I need a new set of lungs and I'm about to go on the operating table to have the biggest surgery of my life, to have a double lung transplant, and I got a text from my arch nemesis, the one person in the world who I just despise the most. And they brought me so much fucking turmoil and I hate them. And they texted me and said, hey, I heard you're up for a double lung transplant. I'm so sorry. I hope it goes well. I'm probably going to go, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Like, I don't know. I can't think of a single person that would send me that message where I would go, you son of a bitch. You know, like, it's
what a jackass.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, unless they finish the text with a bunch of crying laugh emojis and a middle finger. But, you know, if anybody ever sent me a message that was just a sincere, like, hey, this sucks, I hope you're okay, no matter if I know them or not, of course I'm going to be grateful. Like, those are the moments in your life where you need that support the most, whether it's from people you love and care about or people that don't even know who you are.
Yeah, there's such a broader message there that you're articulating, which is it's not just about being sick. It's about just taking risks in life, in whatever situation, yes. Whether it's about an opinion you have, whether it's about reaching out to somebody. We're all so afraid, myself included, often of reaching out to somebody to check in on how they're doing or to touch base about an elephant in the room that you don't want to address because you're afraid. And most times, if you do it sensitively and with common sense, it's probably going to work out for the best that you've shown some good intention.
Yeah. And you know what? The common sense part, I think, is important because I think, again, that's why I said earlier, like, just take a deep breath. And just think for a moment, what can I do right now? What can I say? There's a few things where you definitely shouldn't, that you just fucking shouldn't say. That people just, but people say it all the time. Even healthcare professionals say it all the time. And they mean well, but they didn't think before they said it. The glaring example that comes up time and time and time again is, well, Shelly, at least it's the good cancer. That doesn't land. You know, that is going to be a fuck up. You're going to say that. That person's going to not like it, whether they tell you or not. You know, so there are things where it's like, just use a little bit of common sense. You know, try not to fuck up, but definitely just like, even if it means prior to calling, Googling, like, what are the top 10 things I should not say? Ask ChatGPT. I'm sure it will give you a fucking phenomenal answer. What are the things I definitely shouldn't say when I call Shelly to talk to her about her double mastectomy that's coming up in 2 weeks? You know, the good cancer, that is good and cancer, just take those two words and throw them the fuck out. They do not need to be said. They do not need to be in the same sentence.
But again, better to call Shelly and fuck up than not call her at all.
Not call her at all. That's right.
But try not to fuck up, obviously.
That's right. Try not to fuck up. Yeah. I mean, hey, exactly.
Well, Jeremy, spoiler alert, we're going to have you back for another episode where we're going to talk about what I think is just the most perplexing thing I've heard in a really long time, how you thought you were living to 30 and you're 36 now, and how the life expectancy has continued to change. We're gonna have you back in our next episode to discuss that. But for those hacks who don't listen to the next episode, tell us a little more about where people can learn more about Sick Boy, and if you want to direct people anywhere.
Yeah, sickboypodcast.com. If you're somebody who lives with an illness, if you're somebody who knows someone who lives with an illness, if you're a healthcare provider or a healthcare professional, or you're a caregiver, and you would like to share your experience, share your story, go to sickboypodcast.com and you can apply to be on the show. We read every single application that comes in and we're chipping away. We've got over, 4,000 people from across the world that are on that list waiting to step up to the mic and share their stories. And at Jeremy Saunders on social media, Instagram's probably where I'm at the most. So if you ever want to reach out and say hi or share, a story or ask for advice on what to say or what not to say, hit me up. Would love to hear from you.
Well, that's Jeremy Saunders from Sick Boy. Thank you so, so much for your story, your wisdom, and the levity that you brought to this show, as you do to Sick Boy. And we will have you back next episode, and I will put all those links in the episode notes. Thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. We'll see you next time.
Hey, Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.